Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we're going to be talking with one of our favorite guests, Deborah Weiss Ford, Managing Principal of the Jackson Lewis Law Firm down in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And we're going to be talking about unconscious bias in the workplace. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Dave. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Excited to talk to you this morning.
I know it's going to be great. Hey, you know, bias. Now, let's be honest. Don't we all have some bias?
Oh, we do. So everyone has biases, and part of what we'll talk about this morning is that we all have them. We should recognize that. And then what we want to do is learn to interrupt the biases so we can move forward in a more productive way.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. And the reality is, hey, you know, people are people and you're always going to have some sort of bias. But at work, it becomes takes on a different meaning. It takes on a different level of uncertainty, a different level of angst. So talk to me a little bit about some examples and why it's so important, especially in the workplace.
Sure. So there's lots of reasons why it's an important topic. I mean, there's the right thing to do. There is complying, of course, with state and federal anti-discrimination laws. And then actually, we'll talk later, that there's a business case to be made for increased profits and increased happiness in the workplace by workers when the employer understands that there are unconscious biases and moves forward in a more productive way. And so, of course, this is a very hot topic in employment law. We see lots of examples. About a year ago, for example, there were two African-American men who were in a Starbucks in Philadelphia, and a white manager called the police to escort them out. They didn't buy anything. They said they were waiting for acquaintances, and the manager thought that they were a risk somehow and ended up calling the police. And you have to question whether the manager would have called if they were white. So, you know, what Starbucks did was close all 8,000 stores in May of 2018 for training. And they did unconscious bias training for 175,000 employees. And you see lots of examples like this. There was an example at Yale University last year where a black student fell asleep in a dorm room in a common area in a dorm. And a white student told her that she didn't belong there and called the campus police. And you have to wonder, would that have happened if the student sleeping were white? And so there are so many examples that we see of this. It's not just a issue of race, but also there's an issue of gender. I mean, for example, you remember that NASA issue in May of 2019, just a few months ago, where there was an historic all-female spacewalk that was scheduled and had been scheduled for quite a long time. And just when they were about to do it, they had to cancel it because NASA realized it only had one medium-sized suit to fit two female astronauts. So, you know, pretty incredible. So you have a race issue, you have a gender issue, issues of mothers and fathers. Interestingly, there was a study, for example, that showed that mothers actually are penalized per child. They earn 4% less per child of what the male counterparts earn when they have a child because they're staying home or the presumption is they will stay home for child care or when a child is sick. And yet, interestingly, men, so fathers, get a 6% bonus. So the women get a 4% penalty. The men get a 6% bonus when they're fathers. And the thought is that the fathers are looked at as being steady, in for the long haul, making a commitment to the organization. So there's just lots and lots of examples of all kinds of issues as it relates to unconscious bias. So it's a gender issue, it's a race issue, but it can be an older and younger individuals, Democrats or Republicans, the rich and the poor, disabled people, women and pregnant women. And so, you know, everyone has these biases. We all have them. And part of the point is to recognize that we have them and then learn how to move forward from there.
You know, it's interesting because you're absolutely right. There are just so many different potential biases that people have. I mean, look, let's start at the beginning, right? I mean, you grow up sometimes in these environments. You are a product of your diversity or lack of diversity or inclusion in school or inclusion in areas that you live. And it's very difficult sometimes to move in different directions. And so, you know, when people start talking about this, you can almost envision some people in the audience rolling their eyes, right? I mean, let's just be honest about that. And so how do organizations, let's start at the front, really come to the conclusion like Starbucks did to make this a big deal?
Well, I think it's all in education, and I think it's all in training. And I think, in part, you know, we have to convince employers that this is actually a business issue in terms of profitability, in terms of happiness in the workplace, so it becomes a recruitment and a retention issue. And I think we have to make it broader. So, for example, it's not just a protected class, you know, like race or age, as we talked about. But, you know, there's a study that showed that fewer than 15% of American men are over 6 feet tall. Yet almost 60% of corporate CEOs are over 6 feet tall. And fewer than 4% of American men are over 6'2", yet more than 36% of corporate CEOs are over 6'2". So there is an automatic issue that we have with attractive people, with men who are tall, who succeed more in the workplace. So I think we have to make this broader as we do education and awareness to say that, look, it's not just the typical anti-discrimination issue, but it's a much broader context of what we look for in an employee in terms of recruiting and in terms of retention and the value that we place on that.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour. I'm your host, David Chulo, and our guest today is Deborah Weiss Ford, attorney with Jackson Lewis, and we're talking about unconscious bias in the workplace. You know, it's also what's important is in this particular case, the interruption of the norm. Right. And I think that is the key to this, because I think you're going to perpetuate the same bias. You're going to perpetuate the same issues, the same thought process until somebody does educate and interrupt the normal process of whatever organization or business does.
Oh, that's right. So the first step is definitely training, and then we have to look at how we interrupt these biases, which, you know, we'll talk about this morning. And I think first we have to sort of define what diversity is and what inclusion is, because they're really two very different concepts.
Well, then let's start with diversity.
All right. So for diversity, what we're looking at, think of it more as a recruitment issue. Who are we recruiting? How are we going to make our workplace more diverse? And look, let's be honest about it. This is a rather difficult thing in Maine and in New Hampshire, where I practice mostly. It's very difficult to recruit for diversity because of what the makeup of the population in these states. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and shouldn't find different methods to do that. So the difference is that diversity is sort of getting somebody in the door, and inclusion is keeping them. And the key to unlocking the benefits of diversity is to use both of these things. So how are we going to get people in of more diverse social backgrounds and protected classes? And then how do we keep them there? How do we remove the hidden barriers and interrupt the bias? And how do we leverage the talent? So it's sort of thinking like diversity is being invited to the dance, but inclusion is being asked to dance. That's the difference.
Well, when we talk about, obviously, diversity, and this has been a topic that certainly in the last 10 years has been pushed by SHRM, has been pushed by many organizations, and obviously gender, ethnicity, race, appearance, health is everything part of it. But today there's so many other parts that are under the surface. Right? I mean, talk to us a little bit about all the different parts that people may not think about in terms of today in the 21st century.
Sure. Within seconds of meeting someone, even if we're not consciously aware of it, we're scanning the person, we're registering visible social identities, the gender, race, age, socioeconomic status, health, things like that. And that often will trigger stereotypes or implicit biases we have, and those may make their way into our behaviors, even if we don't realize it, right? So it's not a conscious thing. It could be that we consciously say, oh, I'm not biased, I don't have any prejudices. But as you said, from our background, our geographic background, our personality, our communication, our lifestyle, we have these unconscious biases. And so people with more visible aspects of differences are discriminated against more often because they can't hide those differences. So, for example, there was a great story in the New York Times about Wanda Sykes, the comedian. She's getting onto a plane to take a trip to somewhere, and a white woman is sitting in a seat next to a black woman. And Wanda Sykes is coming on. She's looking for a seat. She's trying to figure out, where do I put my bag? You know, the usual stress of getting onto a plane. And the white lady looks at her and the black lady and says, hey, do you want to switch seats so you can sit next to her friend? So you know, I mean, that wouldn't have happened if it were two white women, right? So it's this unconscious thing. She certainly wasn't trying to be racist, and Sykes herself made a comment that all racism doesn't have to be nasty. And the point being that it's not a conscious thing. It's an unconscious assumption that she made based on the way she grew up, I guess, and the differences that we all have.
Well, you know, what's interesting is also what I would call a generational change, right? Things that were never talked about, sexual orientation or things like that, have now come to the forefront far more than they ever did in the past. And there's just social norms that have changed that have really made it so that diversity includes things that you wouldn't have thought about. And certainly in the political climate we have today, there's no question that has come to the forefront. How do organizations look at this and say, hey, these things, we kind of didn't talk about them in the past. They're a little bit harder to handle from an organizational standpoint.
You know, they are, because so many things are changing, and the advent of social media and how things are, you know, put across in a nanosecond to a wide, wide audience has really changed a lot of how we look at things and how we deal with situations. And so from the employer's perspective, you're right, it's not all about being PC. You know, I mean, I hate to even, when I'm training, and I do a lot of trainings for unconscious bias, you know, I'm really not talking about what's the moral thing to do, what's the right thing to do. I mean, that's somebody's individual choice. I mean, I think that's really not what the point is here for the employer. For the employer, the point is that you really are going to get more benefits and better contentment and recruitment and retention issues in the workplace when you deal with having a more diverse group. So from the employer's perspective, to me, it's all about education and all about awareness. And the more we educate managers in particular for hiring issues and for performance management to take a look at different diverse opportunities so that we can make sure that we're adding to the value at the workplace. And so that's the type of thing I think that we're looking at.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, you mentioned and we said we would talk about it. So I think that was a good time to talk about why diversity plus inclusion is good for business.
Right. So there's all kinds of issues for business with diversity and inclusion. And so there are lots of studies that really show the positive outcomes that are generated by diverse and inclusive workplaces. So diverse teams will generally outperform homogenous groups. It's not just my opinion here. There are study upon study upon study that backs this up. So basically what these studies show is that diversity, it actually makes you smarter and more productive in the sense that when you put a group of people together who are different from each other, they're going to bring new and different information to the table, and that'll have different perspectives, different experiences, and that's all beneficial to the customer, to the final work product, and so it not only does it improve morale and productivity, but it also improves the product and financial performance. So, for example, there was a really interesting study done at Tufts University a couple of years ago, and it was a study about juries, and what they did was researchers did some mock jury panels. So they had people divided into these mock jury panels of six people each. And some of the mock jury panels had all white people, and some had four white people and two black people. And what they thought would happen is that the mixed panel, the four white and the two black, would do better in terms of the result, you know, be more thorough and things like that. And that was true, but the reason was a little bit different than what they expected. What they found was that the all-white juries spent actually less time on their decisions, by a lot. They made more errors when they looked at the evidence. They considered fewer perspectives. And the groups that were racially mixed actually spent more time deliberating and delving into the facts more deeply. And so the point was that the difference wasn't necessarily that the black people contributed something unique, but they made the white people on the panel work harder to make sure that they were being more inclusive and looking at things from all different perspectives instead of just looking at it from their own perspective. So that's the kind of issue that we see in these business studies that have been done in the past few years.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford, attorney at law, Jackson Lewis Law Firm, down in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We're talking about unconscious bias. And we'll be right back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, our guest is the one, the only, Deborah Weiss Ford, attorney at law, Jackson Lewis, down in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And we're talking about the real situation of unconscious bias in the workplace. Deb, you know, we're talking here, and we ended kind of the first segment, on the business case for diversity and inclusion. Keep talking to me a little bit about why it's good for business.
Sure. So McKinsey and Company did a study in 2018, so just a year ago, and what they found out that in terms of gender diversity, companies in the top quartile for gender diversity were 21% more likely to outperform on profitability. So that's pretty significant. And then companies in the top quartile for ethnic and cultural diversity were 33% more likely to outperform on profitability. So, you know, it's an issue of seeing an increase in profits for gender, for racial and ethnic diversity. And then there are also studies that that show that diverse teams make better decisions up to 87% of the time. 87% of the time when you have age, gender, and geographic diversity. So, and you can go on and on, just a couple more interesting ones. But for women who are Fortune 500 companies that have at least three women directors saw a 66% return on invested capital, a 42% return on sales, a 53% average return on equity increase. So for me, when I'm doing trainings with employers, I'm often making these cases to managers and to people in the C-suite to understand that the more diverse we are, the better the product is, the better we're seeing for profitability and performance. And it's also an issue with millennials. So, you know, look, we all know that millennials will be 50% of the workforce next year by 2020. So that's coming right up. And there was a pretty interesting study by Deloitte University, which showed that there was a 23% difference in millennials reporting higher levels of engagement when operating in an inclusive environment. And so millennials, when they're interviewed, will often say that, look, they're interested in coming to a diverse workplace. They don't want everybody to be the same. And so, you know, there's lots of studies that show millennials will often ask in their recruiting process, what do you do for diversity? What kind of efforts do you make? And this is similar to what we see with customers and clients. They are often asking, are you diverse? What do you do to meet diversity needs? And so it's becoming, you know, huge benefits to the employer to look at these issues more seriously and try to do some different things things at the workplace to increase diversity.
No, there's no question. But, you know, it also benefits the employee, doesn't it, really, at the end?
Oh, it does. No question about that. I mean, you know, you may have seen that 60 Minutes piece on Salesforce, Inc. So that's a global U.S.-based company. It sells customer relationship management software online. And it was a really interesting piece about Salesforce having a complaint made that they weren't paying women and men the same. And basically the C-suite saying, well, you know, we don't look at things like that. That can't be. But when they drilled down and did a self-audit, they found that there was about a $6 million pay gap, which they stepped up to the plate, and they changed it, and they made things more equal. And by 2018, they were rated number one in Fortune's 100 best companies to work for. They saw their quarterly revenue continue to grow and jump 22% to $3.1 billion from a year ago. So, sure, it benefited the company, but of course, that benefits the employee too, right? Pay issues, benefit issues, job satisfaction issues. And look, you know more than I know about this, but the recruitment today in this economy is very, very difficult. So this becomes an important piece, I think, of the recruiting effort, too, to bring people in who may be more excited to work at a diverse place.
Well, you know, you're spot on when you made the comment that employees do ask about that. They do. They do ask about how, you know, what is different about the organization? How do they fit in to the organization? What the values of the culture of the organization are? So there's no question that's a piece of the puzzle and something that is looked at from making sure that they're being paid correctly. And, of course, with a lot of the changes in the law today, you know, pay has really become a big issue. Obviously here in Maine, we're not going to be able to ask about, you know, pay in regards to hiring somebody as of, I believe, it's the, you know, 15th of September. We're obviously already in Massachusetts. You can't do that, and the laws coming, for example, in New Hampshire. But the bottom line at the end of the day, it's already sweeping the nation. And so that, you know, from a pay perspective, it's not even a question anymore. You're just going to pay based upon the value to the organization.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, so I think the next step then is to take a look at the biases and to understand what prevents us from being more diverse and more inclusive. You know, what are the obstacles? And those are the, you know, those are the biases that we're talking about this morning. So, you know, to me, the first step to overcoming it is to recognize that we all have them, and to not be embarrassed about that. It's just what life is, and to figure out that, you know, there are reasons we have an unconscious bias, and how to process that and how to overcome it.
Do you find that, Deb, that sometimes when this conversation comes up, the initial reaction by some executives, and I have seen this, is, oh, God, do we really want to open that can of worms?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I do these trainings separately from Respect in the Workplace, and sometimes I do them combined, depending on, you know, what a client wants. But yeah, there's a fair amount of eye rolling when you're talking about doing the training of, you know, how you're going to talk to the managers and what you're going to say and what the agenda is and what the materials will show. You know, so I think that's the first step that you really have to overcome. It's almost like a bias against these kind of trainings, you know, instead of realizing the import of it and the significance of it to the workplace and how it is really beneficial to everyone. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, and I agree. As we're talking about, we're really talking about, you know, how to recognize and move that forward. I just think that's a piece of the puzzle, right, where employers or C-suite is just going, oh, God. It's almost like we've had these conversations on other topics. You know, how do we bring this forward and not upset the apple cart? Same thing with harassment. Same thing with other areas. You know, what is going to be the underlying issue once it's brought out? But once you get past that step, it really is a great way to start having a general conversation about what it actually is and that there is no, you know, fear within the organization of sharing those issues.
Oh, I think that's right. You know, I mean, it used to be when we did, and sometimes still, when we did anti-discrimination, respect in the workplace, whatever you're going to call it, it used to be you'd get some pushback of, well, won't that increase the number of complaints? Once people realize what their rights are and what's okay and what's not okay, aren't I going to see a slew of complaints? Of course, that's not the case. You know, there really is no correlation like that. I mean, and the whole point is that, you know, we want people to be aware of what's okay and what's not okay in the workplace. And I think with unconscious bias training, first of all, they're some of the most engaging trainings that I do, because it gets people to think about things in a different way from what they normally think. And it gets all of us to say, wow, yeah, I've done that. You know, I mean, I've been in those situations where, you know, I've been in a job and I've had the male boss ask only the men to go out and play golf, or I've had the female boss who will ask a couple of women to go to a spa but won't ask the male coworkers. And you know, when you are confronted with things like that in a healthy, productive environment, I think that's really important, and it gets all of us to think, yeah, you know, I've done that. Now, one of my partners was telling me a story of, you know, she got a phone call at 6 o'clock at night, and they were from a client who needed an immediate, urgent project that night, and there were three associates in the office, and one was pregnant, and one was a male, and one was a woman without kids, and automatically she went to the male and to the woman without kids, not even asking the pregnant woman if she could stay late. And the next day, the pregnant woman said, "Why didn't you ask me?" And she realized, wow, you know, I train on this stuff all the time. I'm pretty aware of who I am and what's okay. And she said, "But I know I purposely did not say something to her because I was concerned that she wouldn't be able to work late because she's pregnant." So it's those kinds of things, I think, in trainings that really light a fire under people to understand that they should be looking at this in a different way. So, you know, that's the fun of the training.
Sure.
The importance
of it. Absolutely. It's very true. Well, you know, one of the stats you talk about is about, you know, under the category of what is unconscious bias, you talk a little bit about the capacity of your brain. And I think that's fascinating. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So the brain takes in about 11 million pieces of information at any point in time.
I just want you to know, in this particular case, I'm not sure I get 11 full million in there. But
yeah,
let's just go with that. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. How about 1.1 million? Can we have a dot in the middle of that? 1.1 million would be fine.
But it can only, you know, we can only, you can't process that much information. We can only process about 40 pieces of information at any one point. And that means that we need pre-established filters. So if we didn't have that, you know, we wouldn't be able to operate in the world, and everything would come to a grinding halt as our brain processes through all the stimuli in an environment. So an unconscious bias is really a mental shortcut. I mean, that's how experts define it, and the best way to think of it. It's like a mental shortcut that quick decisions are based on past experiences, and that can be based on cultural stereotypes. So, for example, if I said to you, Asians are good at blank, you know, you may fill in the blank and say math and science because it's a cultural stereotype, or blank people buy Buicks, and you may fill in that blank by saying old people buy Buicks. And so these are all unconscious biases that we have, you know, based on all kinds of things, you know, our family background, our gut instinct, our personal experiences, our educational experience, our historical influences. So, you know, we fill in the gap just to process that kind of information that we can't do on a regular basis. You know, you look at this as being two people at the same time. You have conscious biases, and you can have, as I said earlier, a firm belief that you don't treat people any differently based on any of their identities or their protected classes, but you have an unconscious implicit bias that, you know, may be contrary to that view. So you may think that you're not a bigot or you're not a racist, but then something will come up and you'll fill in that blank based on your educational experiences or your family experience, and you're filling that blank. So, you know, you could be watching a TV show that has some kind of a ridiculous stereotype, and you could say to yourself, that's absurd. You know, I don't believe that. But your unconscious will, you know, will not have those kind of filters, and will automatically think those things when you're in that situation. You know, so for example, you know, there was a poster. It's a great example. There was a poster put out by the Red Cross in 2014, not that long ago, and it had kids playing in a pool, and they did this in Colorado. And when you look at the poster, they put some things are cool and some things are not cool. So a kid pushing a kid into a pool or swimming under a diving board is not cool, or running on the deck. And for the most part, the pictures that were not cool were all black children. And the white children were shown as being the cool children. There was not a conscious bias to do that. And when brought to their attention, the Red Cross, which is, you know, a wonderful organization, was appalled by it and pulled the posters, of course. But it's a perfect example of how disconcerting this can really be with unconscious biases. You can't always control it.
Well, as you said, part of it is thought processes, and you're getting millions of them all the time. And the reality is sometimes they're automatic, and sometimes they're impulsive, sometimes they're, you know, they're just how they are and how you process that. And sometimes you say something, sometimes you don't. I mean, that is part of, you know, as we all know, we have people that think before they speak and others that speak before they think, right? And so there are an aspect of that when it comes to the workplace and the challenges that face.
Oh, yeah. And look, this is something that starts really early in a child's life. So NYU and Princeton did a study, and researchers asked school-age children. They showed them two pictures. One was a male, and one was a female. And the story that they told these kids was basically: here are a couple pictures. One person is really smart, and so, you know, take a vote and tell us which of the two pictures, the male or the female, were really smart. So these kids are 6 and 7 years old, right? So you know, pretty young. And what they found was that the 6 and 7 year old girls were less likely to choose the woman as being the smarter person. So 5-year-old boys and girls viewed their own gender positively, but 6 and 7 year old girls were significantly less likely to pick the woman as the smarter of the two choices, right? And so that's an unconscious bias, right? Already at that age, that's an automatic mental shortcut used to process information and make decisions quickly. And so these are based on past experiences, even at a young age, cultural stereotypes, assumptions that we make. So it's disconcerting, to say the least.
No, there's no question. And, of course, we're going to talk more about this right after the next break. And we're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford, attorney at law with Jackson Lewis. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on WLOB 100.5 FM.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're having a great conversation about unconscious bias in the workplace. We're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford, attorney at Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And you know what's really interesting about unconscious bias is that, you know, in the last segment we talked about having two pictures, male and female, and they chose. Deb, if it was you and I would never get chosen. I'm just convinced of that. I just want you to know that. It's not even a conversation discussion here. Just want you to know. And by the way, my producer, I asked her, Debbie agrees. Just so you'll know. And that's not an unconscious bias. That's a fact, right? Okay, it's a little different. That's a fact. All right. Well, you know what's interesting? As we talk about this, there are so many different types of bias. Let's talk a little bit about how we deal with each one and what it's all about.
Sure. So overall, the theme is cognitive biases. And these are biases that are mental shortcuts, like mental glitches that can cause you to make mistakes. And it's just a distortion, really, in the way we perceive reality. So because the mind loves shortcuts, and, you know, you wouldn't be able to drive a car and also talk and eat and think about your to-do list, and, you know, you wouldn't be able to do all those kinds of things if you didn't make these mental shortcuts. So under that theme of cognitive biases, there are lots of recognized biases that we can sort of break down and talk about. And, you know, in the interest of time, we can't talk about all of them, but there's several of them that are, you know, important to understand. So the first would be the illusion of objectivity, and that's the belief that we understand the world by direct perception. In other words, we think we see the world really clearly, right? So, you know, what we're looking at it in this kind of thing is sort of like the Salesforce 60 Minutes piece that I talked about earlier, and that, you know, our company is a meritocracy. We don't have any problems. If we, you know, do trainings, we're only going to make the situation work, that type of thing. And so that's an illusion of something that's not real. So here for Salesforce, for example, you know, you had this situation where the illusion was that we're equitable and we pay men and women the same. And then when they did a self-audit, they found out that that wasn't the case. And so we see this a lot in resume studies, and there have been all kinds of research, as you know, with resume studies in the importance of race and gender bias in hiring. So studies have shown, for example, that, you know, if you showed resumes, that identical resumes that had names on them, you know, John versus Jennifer, for example, that more employers would pick John over Jennifer, which is just an unconscious bias. They'd pick the male over the female. But if they're sent the identical resumes and they don't have the names on there, so they can't tell whether it's male or female, then you see more of a 50-50 split of hiring between the John and the Jennifer. So it's, you know, there's lots of studies with this. You know, some of them are with names that may be foreign sounding, for example. You know, if we had John and Jennifer versus Lakeisha and Jamal, what we would see is that the names that are white sounding and particularly male received at least a 50% more callback than the names that are, you know, may sound like it's more racial or ethnically diverse. So there's lots and lots of blind studies that will point this out.
Well, you know, it's probably true when you think about it, and especially here in the Northeast where we just don't have a lot of different names, and it's ethnically challenged. And I think that's probably a real one that people should be very conscious of.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's really even more disheartening because probably the most disturbing part of all of these studies is they actually show that minorities and women do the same thing. So they're more likely to give women the bump down than the man the bump up. So it's a little hard to explain that, but that must be a cultural, you know, how we're brought up, right? A stereotype that even women and minorities have about themselves. So, you know, similar to the 6 and 7 year old girls and how they view themselves. So yeah, it's troublesome.
So what are the biases, the ones that are, you know, that organizations or companies can really look at to try to change?
Well, one of them is called the availability bias, and this is when we fill in missing details with what is most available in our minds. So the tendency to let an example that comes to mind easily affect a decision-making or reasoning. So, you know, we'll see this if, you know, you run a work team, for example, and you want to assign a project, then do you use the person who's at the top of your mind, or do you pull a list of team members to make the assignment? And generally what happens is that what you do is that you may not actually use the best person, right? You're going to use the people that come to the top of your mind, so the same old people you go to over and over and over again. So what you're doing, in essence, is creating these barriers for people that can't get ahead, right? Because they don't come to the top of your mind. How are they ever going to get ahead if, you know, you have this kind of bias and you're not giving them an equal work opportunity? And this, when I do trainings, for example, this really resonates a lot with managers thinking, yeah, you know, I guess I do go to the same people. And you may do that because it's comfortable, it's familiar, or maybe it's a performance issue. Maybe the people you're going to are the ones that you rely on, and then you should realize that there may be some performance issues for the people you're not going to, so you should be dealing with that as well.
Well, and again, that's the point, where your avoidance, obviously, of some of the problems, and that is by nature a bias.
Exactly.
We also know there's attribution bias. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Right. So this is when you fill in the blanks for the reason that someone did something. So you give more benefit of the doubt to yourself or to, you know, what I call the in-group, right? So, you know, what you're doing basically is that giving the in-group second chances, benefit of the doubt, more leeway, and the people who are in the out-group don't get that benefit. They don't get second chances. They don't get excuses for mistakes. You say to yourself, well, no wonder he made that mistake because all people of that group will make mistakes like that. So, you know, a good example that, you know, we use in training is, look, if you forget to call somebody back, you know, you just forget, you're thinking to yourself, well, you know what, I'm busy, and so I just can't call them back. But if someone forgets to call you back, right, and they're not in the in-group, it's because they're disorganized, they're lazy, maybe they even purposely didn't call you back, and we all do stuff like this, right? Or you know, somebody in your group gets a DUI, and you say, oh, well, you know, he or she's a good person, made this one mistake, that's a shame. But if it's somebody in the out-group, automatically you're thinking, oh, you know, they're evil, they're negligent, they should be locked up, right? So we're making these assumptions based on who we like and who we don't like.
Well, the evil and should be locked up part is just frightening. But we'll move on to the next one. Anchoring bias is another one that's out there.
Yeah, the anchoring bias is another one that we see all the time, and this is when, you know, the initial valuation influences the final valuation without you even knowing it. So, you know, you talked a little bit about this about setting salaries, and so a lot of states now, for example, make it illegal. Massachusetts, soon Maine, in September of 2019, that you can't ask what were you earning at your present job, and the reason for that is that you're perpetuating discrimination. So if you're having this anchoring bias of asking me, for example, what did I earn at my present place of employment when I'm applying for a new job, and let's say I earned $50,000, but the fair market value of your job is $70,000, so you may pay me the $50,000 or maybe give me $5,000, but you're still perpetuating discrimination because of that. So studies show that women, for example, earn 20% less than men. And that is broken down into lots of subcategories. Female doctors, for example, earn 30% less than men. Food service workers earn 10%. So, that, you know, depending on your job category. And so here, what you're doing is you're using an applicant's prior salary when you're setting a new salary, and you may not be basing it on true market value, right? You're basing it on assumptions and perpetuating discrimination.
One of the other ones you talk about is confirmation bias, and I always know that you use the example about that, you know, the commercial where are you? I don't see a Buick, and of course the Buick is sitting right there because you have a perception of that being maybe your old grandfather's car.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones, and I think that confirmation bias is really the one that I see most often. So let's start with the Buick ad. So it's a perfect illustration of that. And GM, General Motors, has spent literally millions of dollars on several different ads over the last 3 years that feature millennials buying and driving Buicks. And why? Because they're trying to break that stereotype of only old people buy Buicks. And if they don't break the stereotypes, Buicks are going to become extinct. So in this ad, what they did was they had a young woman who's waiting for her girlfriend to pick her up. And the girlfriend is saying, I'm right here, I'm in the Buick. And in the ad, the woman can't see it. You know, where are you? I don't see a Buick, right? And she's looking right at it because it's a different Buick. It's younger and sleeker and doesn't look like what we think of as a Buick. So for the confirmation bias, you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, you have these certain thoughts in your head, and you just confirm these biases all the time. You know, if an employee doesn't work out, well, you say, well, I didn't want to hire them anyway, right? I suspected that they weren't very capable. Or during their first assignment, they don't do a great job. And so, you know, you're thinking to yourself, yeah, you know, I knew that wasn't really going to work out anyway. You're just confirming something that you already had a stereotype and perceiving, which may not be accurate.
No, it's very true. And then, you know, as we wrap up the biases here, we have affinity bias. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so look, we all do this. This is favoring people who are like you and have similar interests and backgrounds. And so it's a major cause of barriers to inclusion in the workplace, right? We, you know, all of us, even if it's well-intentioned, gravitate to people who are like us, How often do you hear people say, oh, I wish I could clone myself, right? And so, you know, it just is when we're hiring, for example, we may have, let's say we have 5 interviews in a day. And the very last interview, we find out that we went to high school or college with a certain applicant. And we spend all our time talking about things like that, our high school experiences, you know, what we did, and so forth and so on. And so, you know, what we're doing is looking for a clone or a person who has the same similarities, looks at things the way we look at things. But that's a mistake, and that's a mistake that we all make, because you may not be getting the most qualified person. And if you're all getting the same thing, then you're not getting any kind of diversity, you're not getting different perspectives, you know, you're basically falling right into that trap of really reducing your efforts of diversity, both in the recruitment and the retention area.
And when we come back on the last segment of the show today, we're going to talk about strategies to interrupt the unconscious bias. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, our guest has been the one and only Deborah Weiss Ford, and she, of course, is with Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And we're talking about unconscious bias in the workplace. Deb, as we wrap up the show today, how about talking to us about strategies of how really to interrupt unconscious bias in the workplace?
Sure. So, you know, as we said, look, education is the most important piece of it. So when we're training in the workplace, we want to train managers, in particular, people in the C-suite, boards of director, but the general employee population as well. And what we're trying to do is remind people that we all have biases, right? We all have them. And many, many studies have shown that part of the way to interrupt it, you know, to change the biases, are to slow down, especially for big decisions. And when you give them a little bit more time, that allows your conscious part of your brain to have more say-so in the decision than your unconscious. And so that the time pressure of it, stressful situations, becomes a big deal in terms of awareness and how we're going to interrupt the bias. So education is the most important thing. You know, we call it awareness of ways that implicit bias can factor into our thought processes and our decision-making. That's the first thing that we want to look at.
What is the second most important part?
So the second part of it is, you know, after the awareness part, and the second part of it is looking at behavioral changes, right? We want to seek out diversity, and that can be in the hiring process, you know, reviewing job descriptions, to make sure that we're not chilling diverse candidates, make sure that we only have the essential things in a job description, and that we're looking for candidates who are going to be diverse. And again, not just in protected classes, but old and young and all different walks of life and different perspectives, which is going to help us. So we want to review our recruitment efforts to ensure that they reach a sufficiently diverse candidate pool. We want to establish an internal team to work with the hiring committee to broaden the candidate pool, encourage diverse candidates to utilize their own networks for recruitment, conduct blind resume reviews. You know, as we talked about, that can be a huge impediment to diversity. So all of those kinds of things in the hiring process are really helpful.
At the end of the day, doesn't it come down to each individual person and what they need to do from a recognition point to a change perspective?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that's definitely right. I think we all have to, you know, think about how we look at things and what we're looking at. And as I said, if we're looking to clone ourselves, that's really not a great way to hire. I mean, it may be fine for a couple of people, but you know, you can't have an entire workforce like that because all of us have weaknesses. And the more we bring in people to deal with our weaknesses and to give us a different perspective, the better off we're going to be.
What do you think is the number one thing that an employer, when they're getting ready to do this, needs to think about before they call you and have them come in and train?
I think they need to think about their workforce. I think they need to think about what is it currently like? You know, do they have diversity in all of these different categories that we're talking about? So first you need to do an assessment of what you have. And then I think you need to do an assessment of where you want to go. Where do I want to be? What could be better? You know, what am I looking to get? And then from there, we're looking at two things. One's the recruitment, which, as we said, is very difficult in northern New England, but it can be done, and there are actually recruiters who specialize in more diverse candidates. So that's one thing. And then we look at retention issues. What type of diversity things can we do at the workplace to have people more engaged? And lots of major companies have done all kinds of things, to forming committees, to, you know, having days devoted to diversity efforts, to making sure that we're more inclusive. Millennials, for example, are often very involved in diversity committees, and that's a good thing. So we're looking at behavioral changes, we're looking at structural changes. You know, I mean, one quick story of symphonies, musicians. And so most musicians are male. And so what they found is when they do blind auditions, in other words, they put a screen so they can't see who is auditioning. And when they do that, they're finding that they're hiring more women. But that makes sense. But what was even more interesting, at least to me, is that not only are they hiring more, but they're finding that more women are applying because they see an open door and they see an opportunity and they see, wow, I can be accepted and I can excel in this area. So it's exciting stuff. You know, it calls for a lot of awareness and a lot of looking at the organization and trying to figure out, how do we do better?
It starts with each person realizing it's real, and second, to make a difference. And I think you've done a great job of explaining why unconscious bias in the workplace is something that everybody should be aware of. Deborah Weiss Ford from Jackson Lewis, Managing Partner, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Dave. It was fun. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Liz Johnston from VeralDana. Social media is more prominent and influential than ever, and many of your employees likely maintain an online presence. And while social media can be a great marketing and business development tool, having a social media policy in place is essential to protecting your organization and prevent blurring personal and professional lines in employees' online content. When drafting a policy, think about who is authorized to speak on behalf of your organization, what specific confidential or proprietary information you want to protect, and your expectations that employees engage respectfully with fellow workers, customers, and others working on behalf of your company. Also, provide for what consequences employees might have for violating the policy. However, it's also important to make sure that your policy complies with NLRB guidelines and does not deter employees from engaging in protected concerted activity and discussing terms and conditions of their employment. For help navigating the nuances of your social media policy, contact me or another member of VeralDana's Labor and Employment Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.